welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today, we continue our coverage of the California Walnut Industry Meeting and Commodity Classic, but we start with the latest snow survey. A farmer, who I'll call a state water expert, is joining us. A fifth straight dry month is now officially on the books. State surveyors reported that the Sierra snowpack has slipped even further below average. The survey results were released Tuesday, and they showed that the statewide snowpack is at 61% of average. That's compared to 70% at last month's survey. Joining us now is sixth-generation Central Valley farmer and president and CEO of Bowles Farming Company out near Los Baños, Cannon Michael. Looking at the water situation, it seems like a conversation that, you know, farmers around California have every other month or every month, but the latest news isn't good. Farmers have been warned to expect low water supplies. And at this point, I'm wondering, what are you bracing for? And what have you heard at this point?
Well, so a lot of us, you know, California has a lot of infrastructure, and so it's managed by the state of California, and then there's also a federal component. And so water users have different contracts and rights, so it can be a very different picture, and also the hydrology of the state is usually a little wetter in the north, and so it's very complicated, but for the most part, it's been very dry, and the snowpack is low. All the major reservoirs are low, and so the allocations, the state contractors had given out a 10% allocation of surface water quite some time ago, and then recently just the federal allocations came out. And so even the folks with the most senior water rights in California, which isn't a huge block of people, but they've been put into a critical category, which would be that they would only get 75% of their normal supply. And then the majority of ag contractors for the Central Valley Project or the federal side are getting a 5% allocation of their surface supplies. So, you know, huge cuts for agriculture and, you know, a difficult situation for sure.
So the majority of our listeners are farmers, so they know this, but just for everybody else, explain what farmers do when you only get 5% of the water you're supposed to get.
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, this year I think a lot of farmers with low allocations will be forced to turn to groundwater if they can. The things that I think that some people don't fully understand is that we've already made a lot of decisions, which would be depending on the crops that people grow. For example, like processing tomatoes or other tomatoes or even watermelons. And a lot of crops start from transplants. And so those have already been, for the most part, purchased and put into greenhouses. So huge investments in seed and then renting space in the greenhouses have already been made. And so for those of us who grow those types of annual crops, you know, a lot of investment has already been put into place, and I think, you know, some people did look at the hydrology prior. You know, the winter months were pretty tough also. So, you know, I think guys have been more conservative in terms of how much they probably would put into the greenhouses. So, you know, people probably made some conservative decisions there. You know, folks with permanent crops that are like the trees and things that pretty much have to have water. I mean, the guys are trying to figure out what, you know, to make sure that there's some supply available. And generally that would mean that they wouldn't plant any annual crops if they have annual cropland, that they wouldn't plant any annual crops just to make sure that they would have water for the trees or the vines in the case of grapes. And so, you know, people have, last year was sort of a dry year, and this year again, and I think we've had a kind of been in a drier pattern over the last few years. And so, you know, people have tended to be more on the conservative side. And then this year, probably not quite as stringent, but a lot of districts are really starting to focus on groundwater due to the regulations. So over the next decade, we're going to see, you know, a lot less availability of groundwater, which, you know, has been something that has helped growers get through the tough years like this, but won't be as much of a resource going forward. So, you know, it just exposes, you know, how critical the situation can be, and just also that we still need to be able to use the infrastructure that we have to move water supplies around, and there just are a lot of constraints related to doing that. And so the outlook for, at least from a stability standpoint for California farmers, is pretty tough right now.
Right, it is. And as you brought up too, with the new groundwater regulations that you're also starting to have to manage for, and you know, with Sigma coming in, and now we're looking at more dry. Does it feel like that you're just always fighting a battle? And what can you do? Because water is something you can't just make it appear. So what can you do?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think if you ask farmers in California, or a lot of businesses in California, not just agriculture, I think people do feel like they're in a battle. And again, you know, I think there's a line of where you, a lot of the regulations and things that we face, you know, ostensibly sound like good things, you know, protections of the farm workers and paying, you know, high minimum wage and overtime, and all those things are positive. And then, you know, you would think would be positive, but the problem is we have so many regulations in terms of, you know, leading the country or the world on climate change regulations, leading the world on, you know, air quality, water quality, worker protections, those worker pay. When you lead on everything and other places don't have the same rigor around those things, you know, it just is really hard for California to be competitive. And that's why we continue to focus on, you know, the highest value, highest quality kind of niche crops that we can do. But again, there's can be a lot of risk associated with those crops. And so it's a precarious position. And, you know, farming, of course, continues to be a very capital intensive business. And so you're making, you know, huge investments in either irrigation technology, which, you know, to answer your question, would be, you know, some of the things that I know growers have focused on quite a bit would be, you know, enhancing irrigation efficiency. But again, you know, that only goes so far. And, you know, even with the best technology, the latest, you know, drip irrigation and things like that, I mean, for me to grow a tomato for people still takes, you know, it takes water. You know, these things, you just can't get away from the idea that growing food and fiber, you know, takes water to do it. And, you know, people are agricultural water users every day in our own lives. Whether you're a farmer or not, you're benefiting from, you know, a farmer when you put on your clothes or getting your sheets, and you're benefiting, obviously, when we sit down and break bread or whatever we do multiple times a day. And so, you know, I think the calculus needs to be, where do we want things to come from? And do we want them to be coming from people who are held to very high standards, or are we willing to accept things from wherever? So, you know, the California farmers, because of the challenges that we've talked about a little bit, have made big investments, like I said, in, you know, advancing irrigation technologies to the point where there's not much else that they can do. And then also keeping in mind that not every crop lends itself to like drip irrigation. So you can't just only have that as a tool. But, you know, I think farmers are very judicious with the resources that we do get. And then it's just a matter of, you know, can we get the water that we need to do the jobs that we need to do? And that's proving to be extremely difficult and doesn't look like it's going to get any easier.
And can you remind me what crops that you grow out there near Los Baños?
Yeah, so we grow quite a variety of crops. Some of the bigger acre blocks that we do are processing tomatoes and fresh market tomatoes. We also grow some extra long staple cotton, which is a very high value cotton. And then we do a host of root vegetable crops, which would be carrots and garlic and onions. And we do watermelons and cantaloupes and honeydew. We do some herb crops, which would be basil and oregano and some other ones there. And then we do some organic crops as well, some organic tomatoes, and do some organic corn that goes for some feeding of chickens that are raised organically for meat. And We do have some pistachios and some almonds, but those are pretty small parts of what we do. We do grow some wheat as a cover crop on fields that don't get irrigated over there. We'll fallow some fields and grow wheat. So we have pretty broad diversity. And again, we're just trying to do the best with managing the resources that we have and making sure that we have enough water to do what we need to do every year.
You know, you and I actually, we have talked before, but it's been a couple of years, so I don't expect you to remember. But we talked about conservation and sustainability, I believe, before. And I know that that's something that you take very seriously, of course, as most farmers do, because you take care of the land that you grow things on. But are there any practices that have helped you in the past when we've had exceptionally dry years? I mean, again, like I say, I almost feel like every year is a very dry year in California anymore. But are there any practices that do you have a handbook that you can go to?
Yeah, we continue to do a lot of work on our soil health, that's, I don't think that's anything new. We've been farming the same land here. Our family has for over 160 years. And so, I think there's sort of a narrative out there that farmers don't know how to take care of their soils. And that may be true in some developing countries where people are, tearing down rainforests and doing things to bring new land maybe into production. But here, I think there's a pretty good, our soil is so important to us, but, I think we can make improvements and increasing the organic matter. And so, experimenting with cover crops, people think has promise. We think, being able to add additional compost and organic matter, maybe by just applying those types of things. And compost is something in California anyway, where a lot of green waste is being legislated to be collected in the cities, but it's also being legislated to not go to the landfills like it used to because of the gas release, the decomposition releases into the atmosphere, those greenhouse gases and things. And so if it can be brought to a farm and composted and then put back into the soil, you can get some better water retention benefits and then also sequester some carbon, do some other positive things. So, again, I think, farmers generally are very good stewards of their resources. And I think that's especially true in California because of the high cost of doing business. We don't just go, spray anything or, everything we calculate everything we're going to try to do so that we, if we can let the beneficial insects, battle the predatory insects and do the job for us, then we certainly don't want to go spray a field. And if we can use our water correctly and just the right amount, we don't have to, there's no benefit to overusing water in any crop. Actually, you can do damage if you do too much water, or obviously if you do too little. So I think, farmers are very judicious with what they have, but going back to the point I made earlier, it still takes water to do what we do. And I think that's just the thing that people just somehow want to think that you can have dry land tomatoes. I was on a call the other day where a woman suggested to me that maybe we should just look to do dry land tomatoes that would taste better, but would sell for a higher price. So, that's if you know about reality, that's not what farmers are really going to be able to do to support themselves. So, we need constructive ideas, and we know what to do when we get the water. And California is the right place to grow things because if we get water, our yields are much better for each ounce or gallon or however you want to measure it of water produces quite a bit of whatever the crop is versus other locations. So we're blessed in a lot of ways, but we have a lot of constraints and a lot of challenges. And hydrology is definitely something that is challenging in these dry years, but we also have some challenges around the management of the water system. And we do want to make sure the system gets managed to help the environment, but I think we also have to look at the balance of making sure when water does become available in some of these big storms that we've seen, you know, that there's opportunities to capture that water intelligently and move it to maybe either where you could recharge it into the ground or whether you could store more. So, you know, California just isn't making the investments. You know, it made a bunch of investments in the, you know, 40s and 50s, but hasn't done a whole lot since then to improve infrastructure. And so, again, I think, you know, we do get opportunities to capture water, but a lot of it gets missed. And then we also get opportunities to move water, and those opportunities also often get missed. And so I think California just really needs to kind of reckon with itself and kind of understand that we maybe can do better where, you know, farmers can get a little more stability and hopefully where the environment can do a little bit better at the same time. So, you know, it's complicated, and you've got a lot of people that are entrenched and don't want to give an inch. And so it makes it difficult, but, you know, right now things look pretty bleak for the environmental folks, and things don't look very good for a lot of the farming folks. And so I would hope that people would want to come together and make some better progress.
Absolutely. I try to end most of my interviews on a bright spot, but when you're talking about water in California, it's really hard to find one. But, you know, is there, if you could speak individually to every farmer in California, what would you tell them?
Ooh, if I could speak individually to every farmer, what would I tell them? Well, I would tell them, I think that they're some of the best in the world, and that, you know, we do offer a number of benefits. I do think we need to make some different friends than we've had in the past, and try to find ways to build some bridges. You know, because California seems to want to stay in a mode of regulating, you know, people quite a lot, and I think we need to tell our story better and connect with people who, you know, value agriculture and the nature of you know, we're operating again in a very highly regulated area, and we're doing a lot of the things that are the right things to do. And I think we're, again, some of the best in the business and taking care of people and taking care of the planet and, you know, the environment around us and doing all the right things. And we've got to find ways to get more people on our side, and some of these big, you know, corporations that talk about sustainability and, you know, caring for people and all those things. I think they need to put their money where their mouths are when they're sourcing, and, you know, hopefully with more transparency, and, you know, hopefully the consumer at some level, you know, values, you know, I think people talk a lot about valuing, you know, protecting workers and protecting the environment. But if the dollars are going to be spent, you know, sourcing things from other places, you know, you're really kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth. But, you know, we as farmers are, I think, we need to engage in different ways than we have in the past, and be open to building some relationships maybe with some folks we wouldn't traditionally maybe work with as much, because, you know, we have to improve. You know, California voters care about the environment, and California voters, you know, care about disadvantaged communities and things like that. And we need to be mindful that those are things that are important, and you know, we've got to play our part in making California not just an agricultural state, but a state that also you know, supports communities and supports the environment. And I think that's all things we want to do, and hopefully by making more friends, we can get people to help us solve some of these issues.
Thank you again to Ken and Michael. Still to come, we are back at the California Walnut Conference, but first we have today's news brief. That's right after this.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. In the last segment, we were talking about water here in California, but nearly half of the country is suffering from drought. Stephanie Ho with the USDA has details.
Despite flooding in the interior southeast, many other parts of the country are dealing with drought.
As we head into meteorological spring, almost 46% of the country is experiencing some degree of drought, much of that across the western half of the United States.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says drought becomes more of an issue as the nation heads into the growing season.
We are going to be dealing with the potential for drought impacting early planted crops in the southwest and across parts of the south, and then eventually into the western United States. Really no sign of any significant relief coming anytime soon for those dry areas.
In other parts of the country,
still early in the season, planting, of course, across the Great Plains won't be underway for several weeks, but we are seeing some impacts already on things like winter wheat. So that is something that we have to be tuned into heading forward, as spring is coming fairly quickly.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has the National Weather Service forecast for the second week of March.
We're looking at a warm start to spring across the eastern half of the country with above normal temperatures there. Does look like it'll be on the chilly side, though, across the west, particularly from the Pacific coast to the western slopes of the Rockies. In terms of rainfall and snowfall patterns from March 9th through the 15th, a lot of the country expecting near or above normal precipitation. That does include some potential favorable rain and snow showers in Southern California and the Southwest. Could also be wet in the Northern Plains and the Midwest. Looks like a little bit of a break for the South with near or below normal precipitation following the heavy rain of late February. Also, it looks like it'll be on the dry side in the Pacific Northwest.
In other news, there are new dates for the Organic Produce Summit. The summit was to be held in July, but now will be September 15th and 16th in Monterey. Last year's summit was canceled due to the COVID pandemic. Organizers say they're working with state and county officials in monitoring the current COVID situation. They're also working with sponsors and attendees on assessing the best opportunities for the summit to hold an in-person event this year. The newly rescheduled summit will be held at the Hyatt Regency Monterey Hotel and Spa. They say the location is big enough that some sessions can be held outdoors if needed. Recent USDA efforts to clarify import-export regulations of plant materials and seeds via e-commerce has its roots in the arrival of unsolicited seeds to citizens last year. Rod Bain explains.
Quite an uproar was caused last summer when thousands of unsolicited seed packages arrived to citizens via the mail. USDA's investigation found some were sent as part of a brushing scam, and some were actually ordered online by customers, at most sent with no intent to harm. However, most shipments entered our country illegally without a proper permit or phytosanitary certificate. So to that end,
we have been working with e-commerce companies to remove the online sellers that are illegally importing or facilitating the illegal imports of propagative materials, including seeds.
Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Deputy Administrator Osama El-Lisi says this is part of recently announced clarifications to guidance regarding online sales of plant material and seeds, and how both buyers and sellers can comply with U.S. law. And as he points out, there is specific steps required of sellers of such product online.
Those who are interested in either importing or exporting products from overseas must apply for and obtain an import permit from USDA APHIS.
These entities must also obtain specific shipping labels from APHIS.
This is something that APHIS will provide those labels with the import conditions included. Inform the seller overseas about the labeling and shipping requirements detailed in the permits, but also instruct the seller to include an invoice that states the specific name and quantity of plants or seeds in the shipment.
And more importantly, according to the deputy administrator,
the exporter must also receive a phytosanitary certificate from the National Plant Protection Organization of the country of origin, and then instruct the seller to use labels provided by the buyer to ensure plants or seeds are delivered to one of the APHIS Plant Protection Quarantine Plant Inspection Stations.
Additional information about importing plants and plant materials for planting is available at APHIS's website. The address is www.aphis.usda.gov. Click on the Our Focus tab, then the link to Plant Health to find this information. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's a little early to be thinking about Christmas, but a tree from the north coast of California will serve as the official U.S. Capitol Christmas tree. This from the California Farm Bureau. The Six Rivers National Forest, which is based in Eureka, announced it had been chosen to provide the tree. The tree will be placed on the west lawn of the Capitol in early December. It's the first time a tree from the Six Rivers Forest has been selected. The fifth time a tree from California will serve as the Capitol Christmas tree. That is your news brief for today. When we come back, we check in on conferences happening this week. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. That is there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. The California Citrus Showcase is happening today. It's being held virtually by California Citrus Mutual. Another conference this week is the California Walnut Board and Commission's industry meeting. It was virtual as well. We had highlights from day one in yesterday's show. Today, we have some highlights from day two. In a session on the board and commission and the return on investment, Speaker Donald Noreen of Noreen Ranches Incorporated answered a question on the new credit back program.
The California Walnut Industries credit back program is modeled after the successful almond industry, almond board's credit back program. And so the concept, as I appreciate it anyway, is that for every $1 spent in promotion, advertising, product development, work on new product development, especially that a handler, processor, and it has to come back to the processor level. This is not a rebagger who's not aligned with a processor. For every $1 they spend, they would get 70 cents back for authorized expenditures from the California Walnut Board. Every year, the California Walnut Board in the budgeting process would allocate a certain portion of our overall budget assessments to that program. And so we can, you know, annually we can designate and compare success versus additional investment, et cetera. So that when I talk about expanding the investment in marketing, that's where the 30% expansion comes from, is that we're going to incentivize folks, marketers, product developers, whatnot, to do work because we're reducing their overall cost for doing so. And holding the success of your model, they would see that, you know, additional investment is going to return much more to them for that effort. And then hopefully that trickles back to the growers who are, you know, putting up the initial investment in assessments. So that's my understanding of the program, and I hope that makes sense to most growers who are, you know, a little conscientious about how much we're paying in assessments as a percentage of our overall crop dollar receipts these days.
In a session on research, growers got an update on the latest advancements. Dr. Pat Brown from the UC Davis Walnut Improvement Program talked about new walnut varieties.
Our first step in creating a new variety is to cross walnut trees together. So at the upper left, you can see the female flowers at the right stage. The stigmas are just beginning to show, but they're not receptive yet. Here, the sort of middle of the top, you can see trees covered in those bags. We use that to exclude foreign pollen from the female flowers. The upper right shows us harvesting pollen from catkins on those wire mesh screens. And then that pollen gets injected into the bags through using a syringe that we poke through the clear window of the bag. Tend to require less chilling. And so Chandler is fairly late leafing, and so it has a fairly high chilling requirement. And so the message here is we're not going to be able to rely on Chandler forever. You know, we could disagree on whether we can use it for another 40 years or 60 years, but we're not going to be able to rely on it forever. So we're starting to do these chill requirement assays where we cut sticks throughout the winter and put them in a growth chamber with heat and light. And then what you can see at the right is if it's a low chill variety, the sticks cut in midwinter will push their buds when given heat, light, and water, and the high chill varieties will not. And so up until now in the breeding program, we've relied a lot on blight avoidance rather than blight resistance. And what I'm showing in this slide at the left here, we've got leafing date versus blight incidence. And as you can see, as the leafing date gets later and later, the blight incidence tends to go down. And so later leafing genotypes are avoiding blight. However, at the right, you can see as leafing date gets later, harvest date also gets later. And that kind of makes sense. So one of our big things to focus on up till now has been these short season varieties where we get blight avoidance through late leafing, but also harvest earlier than Chandler. And that's been really successful. But moving forward, say in the decades to come, we would expect that in general, these late leafing varieties are also going to have a higher chill requirement. And so moving forward, we've got to replace our blight avoidance in the breeding program with blight resistance. And so, you know, really, we're just at the very beginning of this effort here. We have some really interesting genetics. I'm showing here some Himalayan material that has a fuzzy hull and sometimes some red coloration to the hull that doesn't seem to get much blight. In our trials so far, we're using this material as parents, but we're really in the beginning stages of this. And so what we're working on and really focusing on moving forward is developing a series of high-throughput quantitative blight assays in the breeding program. So this could be detached nut assays, overhead irrigation in the field, probably all of the above in a multi-pronged approach.
We've discussed the new Wolfskill variety in a previous episode of the Daily News Report. Here's a sample of that. I know that this has been several years in the works. What does it take to come up with a new variety?
Typically, release times are somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 to maybe up to 20 years for releasing a new variety. So this cross was made in 2003 when Gail McGranahan was still running the program. It's a cross of Chandler, which, as I said, is the predominant variety. With Solano, which is another early variety that we released. And so it has some of the traits of both. But it's a long process. You make the cross, you grow it out as a seedling. You graft some additional copies, typically on campus. We try to get growers to try things out earlier in the process and put them into grower fields where we can get real life experience with them and get feedback from those growers. So those guys are really helpful to the program. And we keep looking at it and thinking about it. And at some point, we decide it's good enough to go ahead and release. And sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong. So you release a new variety, and then you always worry about whether you've made the right decision or not. This is no exception.
Yeah, I'm sure. And especially when you're dealing with tree nut crops. I mean, we're talking about a long-lasting crop.
Yeah. And growers are rightfully so fairly conservative about adopting new varieties because they're making a long-term 30, 40, 50-year investment in an orchard, and they want to not make mistakes. So more so than other nut crops or fruit crops, more like growers are pretty slow. And as typically happens, you try to get nurseries to take graft wood and build up a supply so that when you release a new variety, there's enough wood to meet demand. And it never quite works. You know, nobody wants to build up something that's not going to be released. And once you release it and we start talking to folks like you, and people call up and they want it, and the nurseries haven't built up the supply of wood. So we try to do both as best we can.
Episode 13 of the Daily News Report focuses on that development, so you can take a listen there. In that same session, Dr. Ken Shackle of UC Davis spoke on irrigation scheduling advances.
How do we know when a plant is getting enough water? And we use the pressure chamber in order to measure how much the plant is pulling on the water that it is getting. It's pretty much like measuring the blood pressure of the plant. I'm sure many of you have already seen this information about this. But the bottom line is that what this device measures is how hard the plant is pulling to get the water that it needs. So if you ask the question, how do you know if your walnut tree is getting enough water? The answer is, well, you check to see how hard it's pulling, and then you compare that to how much it would be pulling if there was plenty of water in the soil. Now, we have a name for this, and we call this the baseline stem water potential. So the pull is called stem water potential, and what this baseline tells us is that when the air gets hotter and when the humidity and when the air gets drier, then the amount of pull that you expect goes from not being very much pull, 3.2, down to a lot more pull, 7.3. So the bottom line here is if you go out in the field and you measure a tree and you measure it at around 4, and you read in the table that it should be somewhere around 4, then there's no point in putting any more water because it's not going to change how hard the tree is having to pull to get the water. And it actually might harm roots. And the reason why we think this is because of an observation made by Bruce Lampinen quite a long time ago, that when he saw these symptoms that you see here, tip burn, yellowing, and so on, in June, July, in the summer, they were associated with trees that had been wet, very wet, near the baseline or above the even less water stress than the baseline earlier in the season. So the idea was that maybe we're sort of shooting ourselves in the foot by putting water on too soon in walnuts and that these symptoms show up later on in the year. So we started our first experiment with this in 2014. And the key grower concern at this location was that they were seeing the trees with a lot of wilty leaves and they didn't look very good. They looked very water stressed when they had to turn the water off for harvest. And the grower was thinking maybe the reason why they were stressed was because they weren't irrigating enough and that they needed to put more water on so that there would be more water in the soil and in the tree's bank account at harvest. But we were thinking if Lampinen is right, maybe it's the other way around. What we need to do is actually wait in the spring to begin irrigation until the trees showed that they were a little bit less or more a lot less maybe than the baseline. So we were waiting for a bar drier than the baseline or two or three or four bars drier than the baseline. And of course, this is we have a lot of cooperators here, and we got started on this project. So what we found in the first year was that if you compare how much water the grower was applying to the trees, that's the black dots, and compared that to how much water the trees were using in terms of their ET, evapotranspiration, accounting for how much rain they were getting during the season, which usually wasn't very much, then you found that the grower was doing a perfect job matching the ET. And our first treatment about waiting for one bar didn't make us wait very long. It was almost the same as the growers. But then when we looked at two bars, waiting for two bars or waiting for three or four bars, it turned out we were waiting for over a month to begin irrigation compared on when the grower normally started irrigation. So that was a long time. So the question then was, well, how do the trees look? And this is where things got really interesting, because the grower irrigated by the book. But when we got to harvest, the irrigation manager noticed that actually our trees looked less stressed. They looked healthier.
In the closing session on regulatory compliance, attendees heard from speakers, including Acting Director of the EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs and Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution. Again, that was from the Walnut Industry Conference. Today, citrus growers are attending their meeting. We are attending that as well, and we will have highlights in tomorrow's show. When we come back, we head to Commodity Classic. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
Commodity Classic continues today, normally bringing nearly 10,000 attendees together from around the nation. It is virtual this year. Representatives from four major agriculture equipment companies took part in a panel discussion on the future of the industry. They hit on several topics, including rural broadband. David Gilmore from John Deere.
I hope that our audience got the message that our companies, our industry, the Association of Equipment Manufacturers is fully behind any effort and will continue to champion the efforts around infrastructure and most specifically rural broadband, because we can't advance in the U.S. the way we need to without it. So it sounded like that message came across pretty clear.
I think it did.
Todd Stuckey of Kubota.
David, I just saw a question come in as to how do I back my data up, make sure I don't lose it on my field? And broadband's how you do it is, if we all go to cloud computing, then it's in the cloud and you're never going to lose it. But you know, if you go the old way and you have to move it around on a stick or something like that, you have a chance to lose it. So I think broadband is going to be our path to make sure the data that we collect is safe and is safeguarded out there that you can never lose it. So it's a key point.
New technology was at the forefront of the discussion. Here's Bill Hurley with AGCO.
Well, I'll tell you from my perspective, you know, again, Charlene, we talk about broadband being a fundamental requirement. AI is as well, because the level of analytics that are going to be required, you know, you back up and you really put this in perspective. We're going to have a global population that's expected to reach, 10 billion people? Mm-hmm. And in only the next 30 years. And that really, when you look at some of the studies, says that the farmers in the next 30 years are going to have to produce more food than what the entire world has grown in the last 8,000. And in order to do that, you have to be unbelievably smart. And that's why we talk about these smart solutions and how they all interconnect. And the only way that you can do that are with very sophisticated AI type approaches. And they have to be connected. They have to be real time. And you know, the way that I think farmers will make decisions in not just the next 20 years, but even in the next 5 years, is going to be completely different than what it is today.
David Gilmore from John Deere.
I might just build on some of Bill's comments, most specific to AI. And I know enough about this panel to know that in earlier days, all of us at some point in our youth, if you're in the Midwest, it was walking beans. Bill might have been in a cotton field, taking weeds out by hand. But the bottom line is we were using intelligence and computer vision and machine learning when we were undertaking that activity. So our eyes were the computer vision. our brain, you know, the decision to say that's a weed, that's a crop, I'm going to pull the weed, you know, that went through our brain and then we took the action. And that kind of intelligence today, and we just had opportunity to announce a product yesterday called See and Spray that takes what Bill was talking about. It's this artificial intelligence through computer vision, machine learning, and does it in real time. So customers have the opportunity to do, you know, at 12 miles an hour, the kind of activity that we would have been doing manually in the past. That technology exists today, and over the course of the next 20 years, it will just continue to automate some of the tasks that our farmers are executing today. And in the future, those will become, as Scott mentioned, it'll end up moving from automation to autonomy. And it will be artificial intelligence that drives that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it exists today to a large degree across multiple platforms. In the sprayer, you talked about See and Spray for sure. In our tillage tools, there are sensors to get to produce the desired outcome based on current conditions. Same thing in combines that are now, you know, adjusting themselves on the fly based on field conditions as they develop. It for sure. And then we look at other parts of the farm operation. As we've talked about, it goes beyond what we get in the field to predictive analytics with what we're seeing on machines. And when this system fails or this part is producing this pressure combined with this element of whatever's happening in the machine system, we know that in 50 hours this system is going to go down or this part is going to go down, and it allows us to proactively impact machine operation so that we can ensure the highest productivity levels available. And all of that is in various stages of development, I think, across, you know, the entirety of our platforms, is going to change the way our dealers interact and help support producers in the field as well.
Absolutely.
Really, AI is going to be the tool that allows smarter farming and use of technology. It's a tool that we're going to develop, that's being developed, that is developed. David just launched it, that is going to allow us to apply the smart farming out there.
Bill Hurley with AGCO.
You know, I think our dealer capacities have to evolve as technology evolves. You know, and you look at the broad spectrum of technology, and, you know, a customer may very well ask, well, how can my local dealer be an expert on all of these different types of technologies? And I firmly believe, and we're already seeing this. I know at AGCO we've got a new approach that we call the AgTech Squared, which is really a partnership between a dealer and company employees all across the country, all across the world, that have access or specific knowledge bases to draw on, and to help, you know, an individual dealer address a customer's technology issue. And I think it's approaches like that you know, will have to be developed, will have to be innovated as we go forward.
Scott Harris is with Case IH.
Yeah, I think to build on Bill's comments there, for sure. And we're fully supporting the network and building those capabilities. And it is an evolution. And frankly, the very technology that we're talking about today that's supporting the equipment and the AI and predictive analytics and all that is also going to support the development and the support and the capabilities of the network that's charged with supporting producers in the field of operations. So I think it will all build upon itself. We understand very well, we're going through it too, that there's a learning curve, and it requires, you know, boots on the ground and going shoulder to shoulder and ensuring that we get that everybody stays up to speed and able to produce at the support that's required to support today. But the support of tomorrow will also be built and enhanced by the very technology that we're building today to increase productivity in the field.
Commodity Classic continues through Friday. That is our show for today. If you know of a topic or a person who should be featured in this, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Crew. Thanks for listening.